I wish that tech industry leaders, iconoclastic public figures, neuroscientists, economists could get together around another hashtag movement. I just jokingly call it Unbundle Unbrand. Virtually any bundled product, whether it's cable or telephone or whatever, we know puts the consumer at a weaker bargaining position, right? You're told that the only way you can access this thing is through this bundle.
Right.
And the pricing is distorted by the bundle. Brian Kaplan points at this in The Case Against Education. How is it that a single course could be offered by University of Michigan on Coursera for $35, but that if you want that to be part of a 4-credit degree-granting program, the very same one becomes 20 times more expensive?
Yeah, and the other thing that Brian Kaplan talks about is that the higher education system has a monopoly on the signaling that people want, right? That's why they can command that price for something that Udemy decides is worth $35.
The School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. My guest today is a former World Bank economist. Listeners are always writing me and saying, Brett, why don't you have more World Bank people on the show? Well, today's your lucky day. Colleen Masenik is a retired World Bank development economist, but she is also a home educating mom and now an innovator in self-directed learning geared towards teenagers. The platform we're going to be discussing today is called the Breakaway Learning Project. As a developmental economist, part of Colleen's job was to seek out broken markets, to look for missed opportunities. She explained this as looking for paths that could quickly improve livelihoods for a large number of people. And the lessons of this professional pursuit kind of merged with home education because she is a mother of five who had a variety of both philosophical and practical motivators for doing education outside of school. She's moving around all over the world. That's a big one. So today, Colleen encourages us to ponder, even though there's really no reliable way to calculate, the immense opportunity cost for millions of teens who are stuck in environments that encourage subordination but not intrinsic motivation. And that's one of the things we'll cover on the show today. What opportunities might exist, again, for millions of teens if they were allowed to pursue their interests with the available guidance of experts? This is going to be the first of many conversations with Colleen. I found it to be a very, very inspiring interaction. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of parents through the years doing this show who had unschooling environments at home, and they had children who reached 13, 14, 15 years old, 16 years old. And those young people decided for whatever reason, I mean, there's lots of reasons why this could happen, that the best path for them at that point in their lives was to enter school. Obviously, school at that point in life fulfills a set of social needs and desires. And one of the other big reasons that I've heard is the track to college, right? The 4-year undergraduate degree, despite its diminishing value in the marketplace, persists as a goal, obviously for schools, but also for parents, because as Colleen explains, it is bundled and branded as the path to professional success. And, you know, a lot of these stories I find kind of frustrating, some kind of saddening that people see that as their only option. But I also understand it. And, you know, one of the things that I've really tried to do through all of the conversations that I've had and all of the things that I've seen in my travels and a lot of things that I saw firsthand with people who home educated in New Hampshire, there was obviously a very active home education community there, is there a way to give maybe just like a general map of the self-directed education process from very early childhood up into professional success. So you hear me talk about Praxis all the time. I was really, really excited to find that overpass, as I call it, around that traffic rotary that people are just circling for 4, 5, 6, 7 years in undergraduate programs. And I obviously I'm a supporter of the idea of very early childhood education being very free, being very exploratory. If you think back to the conversations that I had with Peter Gray, one of the most important aspects of learning at that age is play. And then like the students that I've worked with, you know, by the time they're 8, 9, 10 years old, they develop more patience, more self-discipline, and they actually want to devote time to learning a specific topic or a specific skill. And they get some satisfaction and they're able to build some confidence through, you know, repeating that process several times. But by the time a young person starts to feel a little bit like an adult, they want even more focus and more direction and more support. Once they have some goals for the future, like we talked about in the last show with Zach, who are the models that can help me move this stuff forward? So this is a great follow-up to that previous conversation, but it's also a really important puzzle piece in a much bigger picture, or puzzle. I guess that's what puzzle pieces are a part of, puzzles. So I'm really, really happy to connect with Colleen. And I think a lot of you are going to be really excited to learn about this for the first time today as well. And we would like feedback from people in this audience, specifically how to turn up the volume and raise awareness of this bundling and branding problem with college that justifies the suffering is a strong word, but certainly a pretty unenjoyable and unsatisfactory and unfulfilling trudging through 4 years of high school when, as we've seen, lots of these people are ready to do exciting and challenging things before they get that permission slip at age 17 or 18. So we're looking for feedback in this ongoing discussion on how we can get this unbundle, unbrand message out there. And we'll also talk about how projects like Breakaway Learning can disrupt this status quo. Please remember that School Sucks is entirely a listener-supported project. You can become a member of our AV Club and access hundreds of hours of additional content. You can also become a patron of this show, patreon.com/schoolsucks. And if you're sitting there listening to this request and you're saying, gosh, I really do like this show, I certainly hope other people do that. What you could do is jump into the show notes and find the Shop With Us link for Amazon and shop for books and toilet papers and little snacks and televisions and new computers. And when enough people do that on the regular, that helps us out as well. And if you support us through the AV Club or Patreon, you also get access to an entirely new show we have going on at this point. There's 12 installments of The Discomfort Zone. I'm working on getting this out ASAP, but we just did a two-part 2018 in review. It was a life-changing year for both Andrew and myself, and I would really like that going into more ears. So again, schoolsucksproject.com/AV or patreon.com/schoolsucks. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoy the show, and I definitely look forward to your feedback. Take care. I'm very pleased to welcome to the podcast for the first time, Colleen Macenik. Hi, Colleen.
Hi.
We're here to talk today about an innovative new educational alternative called the Breakaway Learning Project. Before we get into what that is and how it came to be, when we were doing our introductions online over the last couple weeks or so, you told me you've worked for the better part of the last two decades as an economist for the World Bank.
That's right. My background is in international financial systems and as a development economist, and my more recent work had to do with adult education. We lived as a family in many different places. I'm now in Central Asia. My work had so much to do with looking at broken markets and missed opportunities that I couldn't help coming to a broken market that I felt like I was seeing all around me, which is about 10 years of a teenager's life. I watched it because I was homeschooling my own kids at the time. And then I would look around me in many different environments, whether it was Tajikistan or Cambodia or Kenya, and wonder, between the time that a kid achieves literacy and numeracy, let's say that's around age 9 or 11, and the time that we consider that he's pre-professional, like 21 or 22, and really gearing into professional work, There's this gap of time where I see in many countries this grinding away of individuality and enthusiasm in favor of processes that are rigid and predetermined. And I see it as a huge opportunity cost. And so that's really what got me moving in this direction.
Okay. So to be honest, there are some preconceived notions that I think a lot of people in my audience will have that we should try to resolve up front. And I thought about this too. I said, that's really interesting that Colleen comes from the World Bank and developed this philosophy of education that is so consistent with what we promote on School Sucks. I think a lot of people in this audience see, you know, something like the World Bank as this very monolithic and bureaucratic bean counting kind of organization. And in it, you recognize there is this overfocus, certainly in the United States, but also around the world, in measurement, right? Assessment, almost to the point where it kind of smothers and suffocates the students being assessed. How did you develop this educational philosophy in that backdrop?
That's a really funny question. For one, I wasn't working in the education sector. I was more on the side of finance and economics and looking at doing business, what makes business more successful in some economies. But for another, and maybe this made me a little different than some of my colleagues, I'm a mother of five and a homeschooler. But I'm not the same kind of homeschooler that is the mainstream in the American market, in that I didn't do the homeschooling myself. I didn't have time because I worked. So I outsourced it. And when we would live in different countries, I would be amazed at how easily I could recruit advanced or fluent English-speaking graduate students and undergrads in virtually any topic to work one-on-one with my kids. And so what started to emerge in our apartments in the different places we lived was a sort of alternative school that was individualized education, where all day long there would be a cycle of different people ringing the doorbell and coming in. If we moved to another place but someone was really a great tutor, that person would continue over Skype or Messenger or WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. Payments were then over PayPal or Western Union or whatever. It was becoming more complex with the number of kids and with the moves. So as this was happening, I was contrasting it with what I was seeing on the ground. And, you know, in so many countries, whether it's Philippines or Indonesia or Tajikistan, you see little children marching off to school every day with the white button-down shirt and the blue trousers and the nice shoes. Mm-hmm. I would hear mothers practically bursting into tears about how much those uniforms cost, especially for multi-child families. I started to think about this huge gap between what was like a social expectation that we're supposed to tell ourselves is happening through school and what the reality would be of 35 to 50 kids sitting phalanx style in a room staring towards a chalkboard while somebody talks. I also was cooperating with a number of universities in Central Asia as a guest lecturer, and I would use university students to do randomized control trials in the countryside. So I created university teams and I would work with them. But what continued to trouble me was this gap in what a university promised and what it actually could offer. I would be in classrooms that had one light bulb or no Wi-Fi. Mm. They would show me that the place had been renovated, but not a single student came with a laptop or even an Android to the class. So it was still standing in front of groups of students and talking at them. And that was just a huge difference to me when I would come home at night.
Did you ever inquire, I mean, in all these different places where you observe schooling around the world, did you ever inquire about the origins of their particular model? It's something that we've talked about to a significant extent on my podcast. As you're sort of assessing these systems and the lack of success, we could say, did you explore the origins, like why these stifling environments actually existed and persisted, even though they didn't seem to be getting great results for kids?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. In a number of countries, it's Russian-derived, a number of the countries that I've worked in. In quite a few Anglophone African countries, it's British Empire-derived. But in places where there's been considerable external investment, it's probably donors and investors that place these expectations about standards. Mm-hmm. But overlaid with that, in many of the environments I worked, was a thick layer of corruption. So that I worked in many countries where you pay to get into the school, you pay for the exam grade, you show up on exam day with flowers and an envelope, and the whole thing is one giant paid process. Often the professor or teacher doesn't even show up, or a card table would be set up outside the door on exam day selling the answers to a particular exam. And so getting to know my local colleagues and the university students that I worked with, I couldn't reconcile this thick layer of cynicism with, on the other hand, families' continuing perpetuation of the process. How do you keep on doing something that in your heart of hearts you don't believe in? And what I began to see was a generational divide. And it's one that I think I see as well in the United States. And it's that people who are 40, 50 years old and have a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old, they want to believe in it. We want to believe in it like Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. But the people who are 23, 24, 27 are at the other end of a very disillusioning process. Now I'm finding that I'm on Facebook Messenger with these guys day in and day out, and I'm hearing about it. And so that's sort of what motivated me.
So we're definitely talking about a global problem here. I just devoted, I think, an hour and a half on my show within the last couple weeks to something that happened in Louisiana. Did you hear about the T.M. Landry scandal?
Yes.
So the assessment of this in the show was people equate education and opportunity. But unfortunately, people also equate education and school. And if people make that 1-2-3 connection, they say, okay, this alternative school is, you know, the entry point to all of this opportunity. So if you can grab people by their belief in this, yeah, it really opens the door to all kinds of corruption. And I can imagine it'd be worse in other parts of the world.
Yes, for sure. When the school and its administration are set up as gatekeepers to your future or to your parents and your community's belief in your future, people will pay almost any price. But what was so troubling, and on the other hand, gave me a sense of opportunity, was that I see in many countries an emerging intermediate to advanced English-speaking population. They have Android phones, they have 3G mobile, and they are getting on Udemy, they're getting on Code Academy and Hackster and HackerRank and Khan Academy and Art of Problem Solving. They are finding these things. But the weird thing is that they're doing it in a parallel life to this other life that's about showing up in class, taking the national exams, and going to some national public university. Mm. And my question was, why? Why are you doing it that way? It felt to me like 10 or more years of your young life are being taken hostage, and either you know it or you don't know it, but you're fighting against that to establish that you are a human being too, and that these are the years of your life.
So you used Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny as this want to believe. You know, another part of this too is school around the world, or at least in the Western world, is compulsory. So people are going to have to pay for it. They're going to have to send their children there. And I could see, I mean, I have seen this in the real world with people that I've talked to about school and sending their kids to traditional schools. There's a real incentive to believe, because there would be a tremendous amount of despair and frustration if you accepted school as it is as a failure, but you still had to support it and you still had to send your children there. Now, obviously, there's workarounds for some people, but the majority of the people that I've talked to about this, maybe not like listeners to the podcast, but people in my personal life, they don't feel like they have a choice about sending their kids to public school. So that would be an incentive for belief right there. There are some numbers. Going back to the time that I started public school in the mid-1980s, public confidence, this is a PDK poll, has remained flat around 70%. There's some Gallup polling on this that shows a little bit different numbers. People with a high amount of confidence in public school has fallen about 25% since the early 70s. And people who have very little confidence in public schooling has gone from 10 to 25% in that same time frame. But those are the people who are either like very, very confident or very, very distrusting of the schools. I would think those are more the outliers, more the zealots on this issue. In that same time frame, the people who say they have some confidence in the public schools, which I would think would be most people. Some confidence suggests, yeah, I haven't really dug into the issue too much. I haven't looked at the problems. I haven't looked at potential solutions. That number, just like the 70% from the other poll, has stayed pretty flat throughout that entire time frame. So it might just be an issue of people not thinking about this too much, by and large, because it would be disastrous, I think, for a lot of people to do that examination.
Yeah, listening to you, it reminds me of the business problem that I faced in the establishment of breakaway learning. And I think of three key problems that make it so difficult for us to grow in the United States or in wealthy markets generally, and why we are actually starting with low-income and conflict-affected countries. To be blunt, in the U.S., American families have too many resources to throw at education in order to think clearly and critically about what they're getting for it. Spending anywhere between $11,000 and $23,000 per student per annum in secondary schools in the U.S., there's just too much money swimming around to be critical. There's too much money chasing after college. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, in a staff study in 2017, documented that for every increase in federal subsidization of student debt, it's all absorbed by tuition hikes. Mm. So the more debt we throw at it, the more expensive it becomes. There's just too much resource there. The other problem, and I've blogged about this, it's very personal to me, goes back to childcare, and that parents are looking for a childcare solution. I know what it feels like to have little kids underfoot screaming and yelling. I was never one who was able to homeschool small children. It was something for me that I began when they were in middle school and older. But parents then instinctively turn to school because it solves the dilemma of where will my kid be? How's he going to get there? What's he going to eat? Who will supervise him? So that we can confidently go to work and know that it's taken care of. And finally, there are still no vouchers in the U.S. And so you end up with this very distorted market that even though Connecticut might throw, $20,000, $22,000 per annum at a kid's education, to the parents, to the consumers, their impression is that it ought to be free. Anything that is an alternative to school should be free. Mm. Then you create this business dilemma, which is how do you make a competing product that credibly competes with school at a price point that should be zero? Because the consumer thinks of it as something that ought to be zero. If people even had $5,000 or $7,000 in their hands in August because they made a decision not to send their kids to school, then you'd have a completely different market because they would feel empowered to make those kinds of choices.
So they want zero based on their experience dealing with school. Yeah, one other thing that I wanted to go back to, you mentioned the amount of money moving around prevents scrutiny to a certain extent. And I just wanted to clarify, I would think that if especially taxpayers and homeowners are being asked to foot this bill, I'd like to think that there would be more scrutiny. Is it because of the lack of choice? The money's going there no matter what, so people kind of steer away from the scrutiny? What do you think?
If I could focus on secondary school,
sure,
which is really the aim of breakaway learning, I think it's so much easier in primary school to feel that we have a social consensus about what school is trying to do. We all agree we want children to be literate. We want them to be numerate. We want them to have the basic skills to be learners. But that becomes a whole lot less clear as they emerge as teenagers. Mm. And the thing that the student wants from this economic transaction becomes quite individual. What a 16-year-old expects with his life to do with his skills and his emerging interests and his innate talents is going to be very specific. And so any of these efforts, whether it's by a donor organization or taxpayers or a school superintendent, to try to measure outcomes across large groups of people is going to end up ignoring that critical aspect that the teenager is a consumer and the teenager has very specific interests.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, if we go back 100 years, school only went up until the point where somebody became a teenager. One of the projects of the educationists in the 20th century was to extend it to the length it is now. When people do, I mean, I was reading a bunch of blogs written from school sympathetic or teacher sympathetic positions, their solutions to this school failure question is still 100 years later, more school, year-round school, longer school days. That's why there's not enough of it is one of the arguments why it's failing. But yeah, you're right. I think about, I've worked with kids of all ages, and there is a more uniform set of lessons and expectations in the primary years. And then when people start to feel like adults, which I actually remember, you know, I talk about the emotional cost of this on my show, where, you know, you feel like adults, but you're still trapped in this environment that follows, you know, the same form that it did when you were 6 or 7 years old. It can be a frustrating and disheartening experience. But yeah, kids are more self-assertive once they realize, well, hey, I can do adult things. I could have a girlfriend or a boyfriend. I can drive a car. I can have a job. And they want to start, you know, becoming who they're going to be as an adult. So it doesn't seem like a system, very uniform for the sake of efficiency, can cater to that diversity of needs.
Yeah, there becomes a trade-off between the demands of the supervisor or the state to be able to say that our system measurably achieved X, Y, and Z, compared to the growing demand of the young adult to say, I am so-and-so. This is what I stand for. This is what I'm good at. This is what I believe in, and this is what I want to do. And as an economist, I see the steady crushing of that intrinsic person, the intrinsically motivated self, as having a huge social opportunity cost. My background before economics, by the way, was in Russian literature, and I used to love reading dissident literature. I would follow Solzhenitsyn, Milan Kundera, Liu Xiaobo. And what always impressed me in dissident literature was the belief in self-determination and the wisdom of individuals having that capacity to determine for themselves, even when they're pushing back on a state that wants to annihilate them.
Sure.
That is what the individual inherently wants to do. And I can see that that is what someone who's 12 or 13 or 14 is just beginning to show. But they are so systematically pushed back that it's like they're held in a longer infancy where instead all of those energies are channeled toward conformity and the fulfillment of expectations. And there's a delayed sense, maybe when you're 21 or 25, that anyone would turn and ask you, you know, who are you and what do you stand for? There's also emerging work in neuroscience that points to the difference between an intrinsically motivated brain and a brain that is extrinsically motivated or compelled. And I was really fascinated by this and reached out to Duke Institute of Brain Studies to see if some of the grad students there would want to collaborate with me. Mm-hmm. So I was so grateful when a few of them wrote back to me, and then some of their professors talked to me too. There's research by John Marshall Reeves at Korea University who actually performs brain scans on a set of test subjects looking at their thought process under intrinsically motivated and extrinsically motivated conditions and finds that the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in insightful and analytical thinking, is far more activated, and it's almost completely deactivated in compelled motivation or in extrinsic motivated situation. To me, this seemed to just reaffirm what I could see at the macro level, which is that you can only get so much productivity out of people under a compulsion state. If you think of the situation of, I know this sounds like an extreme example, but labor camps or re-education camps, where you would line people up and they'd dig a ditch all morning long and then they'd fill it up all afternoon.
Yeah.
What do you see? Everyone's sort of leaning on their shovel and barely moving and sort of working slowly. And then when the supervisor looks, they'll work a little bit faster. And in some ways, the greatest act of self-determination that they can express is, I don't give a shit. I'm just going to work slow. I'm just going to do the bare minimum. And, you know, if you look at it through that lens, like Liu Xiaobo or Solzhenitsyn, it's their smallest iota of expression that I'm a human being and I don't want to do this, you know?
Right, right.
You We're know, actually pushing that out of young people.
Well, it's interesting, too, that compulsory schooling seems to hijack and repurpose a very real human need, which is the need for belonging. You actually have some blogs posted. Some of the feedback that you got from Duke University is on the website for Breakaway Learning, and I will link it in the show notes. But, you know, it's talking about the evolutionary or how learning has evolved and what human needs are trying to be met through learning. And, you know, school satisfies that need in a fake way through conformity because the need is about belonging. But one of the people who sent some feedback said children are intrinsically motivated to learn to participate in culture, which is also meeting that need for belonging. And mm-hmm. what you seem to be developing with breakaway learning, and we're going to get into this in more detail soon, is a different way to do that. I mean, school only offers basically conformity and compliance, and that's counterfeit belonging.
Yes, it's belonging within your zip code.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I actually have a selection from that Duke Institute of Brain Studies post on your website that I wanted to share. The real answer is not how do we inspire curiosity. A bright curiosity already exists from the start. The real question is, why does curiosity go away? Or to put it another way, how do we keep curiosity from going away? Here is a preliminary answer. If learning is best adapted for a certain kind of setting, it stands to reason that the motivation to learn will best be preserved if the natural setting for learning is likewise preserved. Here's where Breakaway's proposal seems intuitive and fitting. Provide students with settings where they can pursue their intrinsic motivations and then facilitate the pursuit of those interests with the guidance of adult experts. I think that these settings would really strengthen the motivation to learn. The real joy of learning, I think, is the joy of discovering things together. We may say that shared intentionality, i.e. the alignment of mental states onto shared reference, such as shared experiences or shared knowledge, is inherent to learning. Two important settings of shared intentionality are peer interaction and expert guidance. So as we transition into talking about breakaway learning, intrinsically motivated action is incredibly valuable. But one of the things that is also – this is one of the things that actually scared me, just back to T.M. Landry. They showed these videos of kids with college textbooks, you know, kids who had not had a lot of academic success and weren't coming from environments that encouraged a lot of academic success, claiming to be teaching each other out of college textbooks. And even as somebody who is a proponent of self-directed education, I was a little suspicious of some of the things that I was seeing in their promotion videos. So you do – understand that even though there is incredible value in intrinsic motivation, it also needs to be paired with the guidance of experts. And one of the things that was really exciting based on what I saw about Breakaway is you've figured out a way to bring these things together in a regular way, right? Like I think about a lot of people doing unschooling or self-directed education at home, often left on their own for long periods of the day, which in many ways is great, and I've seen wonderful examples of this in action, but they might not have ready or regular access to people who could guide them, advise them, or mentor them in these learning pursuits. The other side of that is restrictive homeschool environments where you have a parent kind of hovering over and just doing school at home, but you have a strong belief in the first model, and that's something that you guys are trying to address.
Sure. You're right that within the market of American homeschooling and unschooling, we see either the purchasing off the shelf of branded supplies and therefore just the creation of a school kind of curriculum in your house. Mm. And we also in unschooling see some people taking a completely shapeless approach where at any moment in time, a child is thinking what he wants to do next. And what I realized is that the mainstream is hesitant. The mainstream is looking for signals of structure, schedule, progress, and outputs. And this aligns with what the folks at Duke Institute of Brain Studies were saying about motivation, that motivation needs goals. It needs peer groups. It needs mentorship. And so we tried to think, well, how do you regularize this kind of behavior? So the Breakaway Learning Platform is basically doing three things. And again, this is a not-for-profit organization, so the platform is completely free. There are no fees or subscriptions or anything. Just anyone can go and try this. The first thing is that it offers the student a tool to build his own learning plan, starting with what interests him most, and to dynamically change it as his interests change. So literally, it says, this is what inspires me, or I'm doing all of this because, or I've always wondered about. And the student types in some words. Through our custom search engine, then, he's pulling up great online courseware, tutorials, gameware, articles, videos, books around the things that he's suggested.
So did you say you built a custom search tool to respond to what the inputs are?
That's right. So it uses Google technology to create a custom search tool that digs through about 200 different courseware and gameware sites as well as tutorials, a number of digital libraries. We include access to fee-based libraries for students who want to have subscription libraries, as well as free ones. But the idea is whether you said that your interest was dog training or early Renaissance art or neurosurgery or saving the blue whale, that there is content out there for you. Breakaway Learning is not a content generator. We're a content finder, and we're going to help you organize it and make a plan that you'll stick to. So you get all this search results, right? And then you pick from the search results how you'd like to organize yourself. And the platform asks you to populate the metadata. So you're going to say, for instance, I'm going to take the first two lectures of this Coursera course, or I'm going to do this entire EDX course, or I'm doing this thing on Khan Academy, but I'm only doing sections 1, 3, and 7. So you put in the metadata that specifies what is it of this that is yours, that is part of your plan, and you track your progress. So we turn it into a daily trackable learning plan that can produce printable reports. The idea is to transform what radical unschooling leaves to your imagination into something that you can show your mom, that you can show your school supervisor.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Potentially could be incorporated even in a classroom to show a teacher. People want to see results at the end of the day. But my feeling is that if your day was 5 articles from National Geographic and 2 articles from the Huffington Post and 1 TED Talk, a documentary film, and you're reading The Catcher in the Rye, you should be able to have a way to document that.
Sure, absolutely. So just a couple of questions. So that's sort of step one. And, you know, you talk about it being fluid. The students are able to update this as their interests change. So first question would be, what's the youngest student who's ever created one of these learning plans through your site that you know about?
That I know about, I think, is 13.
13. Okay. So we are really focusing on secondary school.
Right.
And what support is available to them going through this initial process of evaluating online resources and drawing up at least a first stage plan?
Sure. So as we get started, and we started in Kabul, Afghanistan, and Bow City, Sierra Leone last spring as our 2 pilot cities, I had local teammates who would go to church groups or to mosques, who would go to community organizations or apartment buildings and meet with teenagers and talk them through how this works.
Mm-hmm.
We also did tutorials just to get people more digitally literate. A lot of people had to create a Gmail account for the first time to get people to understand how you're going to use something like Coursera or Khan Academy and how to navigate it. And so that was a learning curve also. But then it's a conversational process, and I spend many hours of my day on Messenger and WhatsApp. We now have folks in Ukraine, Tajikistan, Myanmar, Cambodia, Kenya, Sierra Leone, Ghana, and Afghanistan, of course, who are working on this. And I field questions from how can I get Coursera to give me a verified certificate for free, to will you make me a certificate, Colleen, that has your name on it so that I can show it to my mom? I get all kinds of questions from people who are trying to understand how this works and how it can fit into the trajectory of their own study. I see students as young as 13, but we have also some who are approaching 30. They've been through the entire public educational system, and they realize that they have to absolutely start from scratch to get employable skills. So I could get into the 2 other aspects of what breakaway learning does.
Sure. One more question about that. How often would they be able to, I mean, maybe it's not on a set schedule, but as far as like reevaluation or augmentation of the plan, how often does that occur? Or is it just as it needs to happen for each individual?
Oh, your plan is yours. You can reevaluate it every 30 seconds if you want to.
Okay.
You put things into your plan and they are not, they don't belong to somebody else. They're yours. And you actually mark your own progress. In part, that came about because many of these tutorial platforms don't have open APIs. So we can't just take the numbers from Coursera that say you're 97% completed or whatever and import it into our site. But we also felt that for teens, it makes more sense. At the same time that we were coding this, I've been trying out different aspects with my own kids. as young as 11, actually. And my feeling is if an 11-year-old takes the Coursera course on neuroscience of perception, for example, do I actually expect him to complete it? And should I suggest to him that he's not doing well if he doesn't complete the thing?
Right.
Or is it maybe that he's just going to listen to three different lectures, but then he's going to move from there to a TED Talk, or he's going to watch something on Nat Geo, or he's going to relate it to something else that he's reading?
Yeah, or something catches his interest inside it that might send him in an altogether new direction.
Exactly. And so unlike a university syllabus, which sort of locks in that you're doing X and Y and Z, and you're starting it in September and you're finishing it in December, I feel that a 13, 14, 15-year-old are in a very different position. It's much more idiosyncratic and exploratory. Something, like you said, sparks your interest, but it didn't spark my interest the same way. Or maybe I watched this TED Talk and it threw me in this direction, but it put you in this other direction. And so I'm not even looking to compare that two different people who started from the same particular, you know, Code Academy course or doing something on FutureLearn, that they're going to necessarily have the same result. And that's also why we let the student populate their own progress bar and populate their own metadata.
Very interesting. And, you know, I was talking about this in a show recently with a filmmaker, Jeremy Stewart, who made a movie about unschooling. Towards the end of the conversation, we were talking about this schooled idea of failure and failure being connected to not completing something, right? If you don't complete something in school, you're a failure. But in the real world, you might not complete something because your interests have changed, right? Or you're not intrinsically motivated to move forward with a certain endeavor anymore. I look like, I guess, to the outside, I've done a lot of things with my podcast and my website, but it's probably less than 20% of everything that I've tried to do or everything that I've started doing. Most
sure.
of those
and
things were abandoned.
The books that they start reading.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I have a list of those too. But because many people who would go through this might have already experienced a fair amount of traditional schooling and, you know, made a certain connection between failure and lack of completion with something, this, I think, would be a good opportunity for us to move on and talk about the second and third aspect of this, which has a lot to do with support, connection, and mentorship, where if somebody is bringing, you know, an attitude about failure or some other kind of self-defeating talk to the process, they might find the support they need to push through that.
Yeah. So the second aspect of breakaway learning is a network of chat, a global network of chat. And that's something that we're developing all the time. I reach out through my friends who are university professors and social researchers in many of these same countries that I mentioned. And we will come up with themes together. And then we'll look for people that we know or friends of friends who are capable English speakers and ready to talk about it. And I should be clear that this is not about tutors. There is actually already a well-developed market. I think of Repetitor.ru or Preply.com, which is a Ukrainian-owned company, for boosting your math grade, boosting your English grade, et cetera, just generally doing better at school through a tutor. Mm-hmm. But what I'm talking about is the more Socratic idea of conversation. And because I've lived in a lot of different countries, I have this aspiration for my kids that they push themselves outside of their comfort zone and have thousands and thousands of conversations in their life with very different people. And so to give you an example, we have chats about child marriage with teenage girls in Afghanistan. My daughter did a bunch of these where she was talking to a young woman who said, yeah, my sister's bride price was $17,000.
Wow.
And she told her story. My son was chatting with a pilot in Congo who flew for United Nations. And he's talking about, you know, what it was like to fly. We have chats with Rohingya refugees in northern Myanmar. We have chats with survivors of Khmer Rouge. We have chats with election officials in Kenya who talk about what happened when they did a recount and then a re-election last fall. So it's, again, not looking at learning as something that's going to achieve the same result or even a measurable result for everybody, but rather learning as an idiosyncratic and exploratory process that's rooted in conversation. I don't know if you could convert this into units or put a letter next to it, or if you would just say, you know, this past month I had 37 conversations, and maybe that would be a measure that you're growing.
I guess you could talk about a more authentic type of assessment. I guess I'm thinking of lots of ways that that could work. Obviously, the assessments would be more authentic. A student keeps a journal about their experiences talking with these people, and maybe students already do that?
Some of the students do. The chat marketplace, I initially tried to launch it 2 years ago as a C corporation, and I couldn't get it to work because I couldn't sell it into the existing educational framework. That's actually what motivated me to stop and create this not-for-profit organization and really try to attack the whole machinery of secondary education. The problems were so many. I overwhelmingly heard from very smart teenagers and their parents that I'm just too busy. And am I going to get credit for it? Does this count for something? You know, is this going to be on a test? I had one social studies teacher who hesitatingly agreed to line up his students to do some chats, but then he gave them each a list of questions. So when you're talking to person X, you need to ask this and then this and then this and then this. And they were factual questions. So I said to the guy, why don't you just have them, you know, Google these questions, ask Siri, you know, what's the point of connecting with someone in a faraway place if all you think you're going to do is extract data bytes from them?
Yeah. And you're putting this artificial layer over the conversation, right? I mean, you could write your own questions. That would be a much better assignment, especially for the intrinsically motivated learner to say, I want to talk to somebody like this because I'm interested in this. And you know, also what Peter Gray calls, you know, planfulness, to say the outcome that I envision or a desirable outcome going through this interaction would be to walk away with this wisdom or knowledge. So these are some questions that lay the tracks to that place. I think that would be a much better alternative than teacher assigned questions.
In some ways, this becomes like preaching to the choir, because among those right. who would pursue a sort of free, liberated form of learning, you're not going to be on a call with a Rohingya refugee begrudgingly. You're not going to be doing it against your will with right. some, you know, preset list of questions to satisfy a supervisor. So anyway, that was an initial idea, which is now part of the framework of breakaway learning. And I really believe that learning has to be rooted in conversation, even if they're uncomfortable conversations or conversations that to the traditional eye seem to lead nowhere. I believe that they're productive. The third aspect of breakaway learning is a network of what we call learning clusters. A learning cluster is just a small group of people who come together because they share an interest in learning something. It could be that they're interested in human rights law, or they're interested in invasive species in their county, or it could be that they're interested in correcting the traffic pattern around their city. It could be any number of interests, and they don't have to align with traditional departmental structures of universities, you know.
Right.
If you're thinking like this group is mathematics and this group is anthropology, it's not like that at all. The mentors who lead these groups are self-identifying. Typically, we've seen graduate students and undergrads, but also some adult professionals. They are seeking some additional income usually, so they set their own price. We have no offices. People somehow get the impression that I'm working from some giant headquarters. We have no offices. So these mentors are bringing together people in wherever they can find a place. And in Kabul, these are offices that have agreed to share a room for an hour. They are cafes, university libraries. Sometimes they get a teacher or a professor to look the other way and they just use a classroom space that has Wi-Fi mm-hmm. for an hour or 2 hours. So it's sort of between Airbnb and Craigslist, I guess, a marketplace for self-identification of groups. In Kabul, the first market or the first groups to form were around coding, artificial intelligence, preparing for the TOEFL, accounting, project management, and one group called Getting a Job at an International Organization. Mm-hmm. In Sierra Leone, there was a group called Sanitation. There's a group around hygiene. There's a group around drip irrigation. So you can see that they are quite varied. And my vision for it is that particularly in urban areas, these would proliferate. Like when you turn on your Uber app and you see how many cars are, you know, circling around where you are, that you should see clusters around you. And that smart and inspired people should think of doing this in their free time, would look at it as an extra source of income. And that young people, seeing the great diversity of available clusters around them, would go from one to another. That is that you don't have to wedge yourself to a single cluster. You could be in the neuroscience cluster and in the human behavior cluster and in the marine wildlife cluster, you know, and you could move around. You might find that one topic turned out to be less interesting than you thought it was, or inspired you to think about a new issue that you were not aware of before. What happens in clusters is not a class. It's not a lecture. The person who's the mentor doesn't come with prepared materials. He comes with his life experience and the experience of checking things out on breakawaylearning.org. But the idea is that collectively, you'll make the learning process more intelligent. So for instance, if we're all getting together to talk about protecting the gray wolf in this learning cluster, let's say we're meeting at the Target Cafe at 2 p.m. on Thursdays. Well, the people who come might say, did you know about the Wolf Center in Minnesota? Oh, no, I hadn't heard of that one. But I know that they're taking internships at this other one in Canada. There would be news exchanged about seminars, internships, volunteer opportunities. What's the best tutorial? What's the best YouTube video? Which article are we looking at this week? And in that way, the student who was kind of unsure how to pursue the topic on his own sees pathways. He sees different professional pathways that one might take. He gets a sense of what people are doing who are 2 or 3 years older than him. Or he can be an example to someone who's 2 or 3 years younger than him. Hmm. It makes the learning process a more intelligent one.
So are there any guidelines? I hate to use language like guidelines, but I'm just wondering if there's any general recommendations for how specific or how broad the subject of a learning cluster should be. Is it up to the individual cluster how frequently they want to meet, how long they want to meet, what expectations members would have inside and outside of the cluster itself?
From the platform, there's really no limit on it. The cluster could be 6 hours long. It could be 25 minutes long. The cluster could cost $10,000 or it could be zero. So it's really up to mentors to decide. And in that way, it functions as a marketplace, just as you would think of Airbnb, or, for example. But we believe that with time, the marketplace becomes more intelligent through user reviews and feedback about what's great mentoring, what makes a great session. We intend to add to this over time as we improve the platform, so that mentors can share with each other what makes a great mentoring session, and so that the feedback function can become more specific. We'd also like to enhance it in such a way that clusters talking about similar things could talk to other clusters. So that, for instance, if a group in New York City was talking about elephant conservation, that they could connect with the Naivasha cluster outside of Nairobi that's connected to the Kenya Wildlife Service.
Absolutely,
that there could be opportunities not only for talking, but that as kids get older, they begin to see, I could go there for a semester. You know, I could be a volunteer there. It's what I have tried personally to discover for my own kids one by one, but trying to make it a process that scales so that whether you come from rural Indiana or you come from downtown Manhattan, these kinds of opportunities could be findable.
So as this scales up over the next several years, do you see this? I mean, because we do have, you know, we already talked about people's faith in the current system, and not necessarily opposition, but suspicion or lack of willingness to embrace alternatives. Do you see this becoming a viable alternative to traditional schooling in this country?
I took a lesson from Clay Christensen. He's a professor at Harvard Business School who talks about disruptive innovation. And he wrote a great book about 10 years ago called Disrupting Class, when he anticipated that the U.S. educational system would see a massive shakeup and that it wouldn't be just monolithically directed learning at students. But his fundamental observation of disruption is that it never starts from the top. You don't make a better Mercedes, you make a Hyundai, and that disrupts the market. And what I'm finding in a similar way is that I cannot show up in Manhattan with a soapbox and say, stop going to school, you're wasting your money, don't go to these fancy four-year colleges, it's a farce. But I can easily connect, whether it's in Kabul or in Kenya or in Sierra Leone or in Myanmar, with young people who find me. And then after they find me, their siblings and their friends find me. And they say, I want to do this. And so I see two possible scenarios for how this extends into the United States. I'll start with a more forgiving scenario. The more forgiving scenario is that you take a suburban teenager, let's say Zoe and Chloe in Connecticut, right? And they're going to their nice suburban high school, and their parents have in mind that they'll take the PSAT and then the SAT, and then maybe they'll go to Middlebury, or maybe they'll go to Bowdoin, mm-hmm. and maybe they'll get a degree in women's studies or anthropology or whatever. And then they'll go on to be freelance writers and bloggers and things. But maybe something gets in between right before their junior year, and Zoe and Chloe see that they could go on Udemy and they could learn about how to start a blog or how to use Facebook to market a small business or how to create branding. And then maybe they would take fewer hours in high school and they do more of that, so that over time they began to question, why am I even gearing up for college? Why don't I just work on my blog and my business model and my marketing and building my client base, et cetera?
Sure.
That's the more forgiving interpretation of what's going to happen. But I'm actually very skeptical that that will be the case. I think that for the reasons that I mentioned before, American high school students are not going to notice this happening. But there is an unseen cohort of teenagers and young people in low-income and fragile countries around the world who speak either native or intermediate English, and they don't have the hope or the resources to try to go to a Middlebury or a Bowdoin. And so they are already on Udemy and Codecademy and HackerRank, and they are already using whatever mobile 3G connection they have to take these courses and develop these credentials. And then they're going to be thrilled to have a graphic design or a translation or a coding in Python or a machine learning job for like $11,000 a year.
Yeah, it's kind of like they don't have the option to go along to get along like the kids from Connecticut do, right?
Exactly.
They're more likely to notice this because of higher desperation.
Sure. The clusters that have been meeting most recently in Kabul through the Breakaway Learning platform, the students pay about 50 Afghani per visit, which is about 37 cents. And that's for a 3-hour-long cluster meeting. So the budget that they're looking at per month to spend on their education is a little under $5. It will be the contrast of people who emerge from that system, who have taken, you know, the artificial intelligence MicroMasters from Columbia University online and have taken things from Udemy and Udacity, and who are stepping forward and saying, you know, I'm working remotely for Google, or I'm working remotely for Facebook, and I'm thrilled to be doing it for $9,500 a year. That will really upset the market of the sort of traditional American high school goer who hesitatingly then moves on to do a 4-year bachelor's degree, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is the too tight connection between high school and getting into college that will ultimately undermine what high school is in the United States, because I think the 4-year undergraduate degree will become irrelevant. And it will either happen very, very quickly in the form of a student loan crisis and, you know, political questions about Sallie Mae and the subsidization of student loan debt, or it will be a slow implosion.
Which we could be in the middle of. Yeah.
Yeah. So on the optimistic side, there, I guess, are two things I would put on my wish list for 2019. One is I believe that if Trump can wake up in the middle of the night, go to the bathroom and send tweets that change the world, I wish that he would send a tweet that would say that the executive branch of the United States government no longer regards the undergraduate degree as an essential educational step, but that rather every department and agency will construct its own matrix of required skills and experience that's more specific.
Right.
Because that would be a massive signal, starting with the Department of Defense, you know, right through all the branches of government, that we are not just ticking boxes, and you don't have to spend $30,000 or $100,000 to show that you're the right person for this job.
Right.
That would be one. The second thing on my wish list is I wish that tech industry leaders, iconoclastic public figures, neuroscientists, economists could get together around another hashtag movement. I just jokingly call it unbundle, unbrand. Virtually any bundled product, whether it's cable or telephone or whatever, we know puts the consumer at a weaker bargaining position, right? Mm. You're told that the only way you can access this thing is through this bundle.
Right.
And the pricing is distorted by the bundle. Brian Kaplan points at this in The Case Against Education. How is it that a single course could be offered by University of Michigan on Coursera for $35, but that if you want that to be part of a 4-credit degree-granting program, the very same one becomes 20 times more expensive?
Yeah. And the other thing that Brian Kaplan talks about is that the higher education system has a monopoly on the signaling that people want, right? That's why they can command that price for something that Udemy decides is worth $35. So one of the things that we've talked about in great detail, going back to, I think, 2016 on my show, the term was coined by a frequent guest named Zach Slaback, who was part of an organization called Praxis at the time, building a better signal than the college degree. Are you familiar with Praxis?
No.
All right. Praxis is a paid professional training. A young person seeks this out as an alternative to college. Praxis program runs 18 months. You are placed in a paid professional training with a company that, as long as you complete the requirements of Praxis's 18-month program, they will offer you a job. Last I knew, starting salary, $50,000. So you could achieve this at age 19, at age 20, while others would be languishing in college years beyond that. The Praxis program costs $11,000, last I checked, but it's basically cost neutral because you can make that amount of money in the paid training while you're doing the program.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have, the overpass, but
right.
Also a springboard into a career where you can start building a professional portfolio. You can start building a resume while other people are still years away from even obtaining the credential that supposedly lets them begin that process. So that's
right.
One example of this better signal, but hopefully in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see many, many more of them. As much as I love Praxis, I hope they have a lot of competition.
Sure. Well, one can be a signal that comes from the top, like a White House tweet that says, you know, the DOD, for one, is a colossal employer. If they made the decision overnight that they are not going to have transgender employees, surely they could make the decision that they're not going to consider the undergraduate degree to be a meaningful mark of education. And then just push down on HR officers that you have to really do your job and come up with skills and qualifications that are measured in a more tangible way. Another I can think of is that leading tech companies are building their own online courses that essentially get you to take a taste of what the work is and then demonstrate that you're capable of doing it. So that rather than a sort of smorgasbord of random courses that you took at a particular college, they're looking at the skills that you have relevant to the job that they're trying to hire you for.
Sure. You know, back to the top-down approach, there was some enthusiasm about the Secretary of Education under Trump, Betsy DeVos, as somebody who was critical of the current model of not just secondary schooling, but also higher education. I did watch her confirmation hearing, and at the time, it seemed to be like, oh, this is like, you know, the education system is a pinata, and this is somebody with a blindfold swinging a broomstick at it. It's more that than what I hoped it would be, which was like a principled reevaluation of the system as it is. But 2.5 years into an administration where the Secretary of Education is very, very critical of the current system, and we've seen very little changes outside of things. I mean, that's sort of the hallmark of the Trump presidency is that lots of actions are symbolic, right? Like ceremonies of executive order signings that obviously are a play to the supporters. It seems like most education policy, at least from my observation in the last 2+ years, has been along the same lines, a sort of symbolic or ceremonial type changes.
Yeah. I know that she expanded the range of eligible expenses under 529 distributions so that families can use some portion of 529 college savings plans for pre-college education.
Mm-hmm.
But as a parent who's pushing my kids in so many different non-college directions, it's frustrating that 529 distributions are still limited to what's considered an accredited full-time enrollment, you know, university education, that it couldn't be used, for instance, on Udemy or Masterclass or Craftsy or any number of other fee-based tutorial sites where the fees would be extremely low.
Right.
Not given that symbolic credibility as a real thing. I go back to thinking that if Unbundle Unbrand could become a direction that enough public figures could get behind, that many of the problems we're discussing in secondary education would work backwards from that, particularly in the United States. That is, if the expectation that the four-year college degree changed and it's no longer the thing, then you really do have to ask questions about what are you doing when you're 17 and you're 16 and you're 15?
Right.
Why are you factoring a quadratic equation? And why are you, you know, memorizing facts about Calvin Coolidge and Rutherford B. Hayes? Like, what is this all leading to? If you're not every day feeling direction and inspiration and some kind of a plan for yourself, it would have a greater sense of urgency knowing that your 18th birthday is going to come and there is no tidy package, you know, a quadrangle and a dormitory bed waiting for you.
Right. I think this is definitely something, this unbundle and unbrand is something that a lot of students would immediately get behind. I mean, I went through school, a significant cost to me emotionally, a conformist and very obedient. And if things went wrong in school, I internalized them as defects in me. You know, I never thought about questioning the system. But when I was 17 years old, I remember the day sitting at the dining room table in August, about to enter my senior year in high school, where the first time in my life I had a form that allowed me to pick all of the classes that I was going to take. That was such a liberating and exhilarating experience, you know, as a contrast to what school had been for the prior 11 years. So obviously, yeah, you'd have a tremendous amount of buy-in from young people, but I think it also is marketable. You know, you want support from corporations or disruptive tech industries or public influencers. And I think right now, being part or fancying yourself part of some kind of resistance is hot, not just with young people, but also with public figures. And there's definitely a way to merge or to take advantage of that sentiment. And I will submit it to my audience through this podcast and hope and we can bounce some ideas around, because I think that is extremely promising. There's no shortage of potential buy-in for this, and it's really crucial that this happens very, very soon. So when this podcast comes out, I will ask for feedback from my audience, and if you like, you and I could follow up and do a public brainstorming on how to push that idea forward.
Yeah, I would be so glad. I mentioned it to some of my family members who already think that I'm totally crazy. And they said, why would universities agree to the idea of undoing their own product? And I said, you know, I bet MIT would, because MIT was at the forefront of EDX. And I think that MIT believes enough in their product that if it were completely unbundled and every class was on a drop-down menu and you just submit your Visa card and you're in, they know that they have an audience. And they know that people believe in their product. I think that a few universities is all it would take to change the tide. So it's like, do you believe in your professors? Do you believe in your content? Then go ahead and unbundle it.
Right.
And dismiss the entire admissions office, because you don't need that stupid process. I don't want to pay another $175 for another kid to take an SAT or to take it again. I don't want to write these stupid essays about how we have to, you know, believe that we're changing the world when we're 16. I want to just take the courses I want to take. And if
right.
I only want to take one course from your campus, and then I'm going to move to Wisconsin and I'm going to take a different course there, and then I'm going to move to Shanghai and I'm going to spend 3 months living in a homestay, that's my business. And I put it together and it becomes the package that I want or that I need for the professional path that I'm headed on. I think that there could be motivation around it. I don't think Melinda Gates or the Queen of Jordan is ever going to sign on to this. I'm not sure that Jim Kim would ever sign on. But, you know, maybe Michael Moore. I certainly believe that Anant Agarwal should give it a look from EDX. It would have colossal repercussions, maybe not immediately evident to people, about secondary school. And it would force a rethink. You were describing sitting at your dining room table after 12 years of education, but it really shouldn't wait until you're 18.
Right.
If you knew that the further steps were unbundled and unbranded, would you make your kid go through this lockstep process until his 18th birthday and then open the door and say, hey, kid, actually, the sky's the limit. You can do whatever you want.
Absolutely not. You know, in our preliminary discussion, you said you were curious about how how the deconstruction of high school could enable the deconstruction of college, I think we're agreeing it would very much work in the reverse in a lot of cases. If college was deconstructed the way we've been talking about over the last several minutes, anybody sitting in high school would go, what on earth am I doing here? And then that question would have to, at least for parents, extend down to middle school. If so much of the middle and secondary experience is about feeding higher education, for a majority of people, at least in the United States, a lot of very good questions would appear very rapidly, I think, if even just a handful of colleges started to unbundle like you're talking about.
I'm excited to see it. I'm really optimistic that the change could happen. I hope that the university system is not headed for the same kind of crisis as the real estate market in 2008. I worry that it is, that there's just too much heat in it, and that the more philanthropists, you know, rally around the flag of education, the worse it gets. Mm. I jokingly told my friends that I need Louis C.K. on my side. I need somebody who really doesn't give a damn and will just tell the truth, because it's not going to come from the Queen of Jordan and it's not going to come from Melinda Gates. It has to be someone who says, wait a second, you know, what on earth are we doing sitting in these schools for all these years? And is it really doing a public service to keep rallying around this?
Absolutely. Louis C.K. was one of the first famous people I ever heard say the words, school sucks. So,
yeah, there you go. So it's your first fan.
Yeah, I would love to follow up and see how this project evolves for you. I mean, we don't even have to wait for any sort of long-term evolution. We could follow up on this discussion in a couple of months. And I think there's a lot of people in this audience who are home educators and unschoolers who would be really excited about checking out what you're doing. So what's the best way for them to do that? And then I have one more follow-up question for those people.
Okay, sure. I am not fancy at all. Just contact me on Facebook Messenger at colleen.masenik. You can find me on Facebook. You can find Breakaway Learning on Facebook at Breakaway Learning, or check us out on breakawaylearning.org. Yeah, I'm happy to follow up with anyone. My Skype is also colleen.masenik.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And if somebody in my audience was interested somewhere in the United States, or we have lots of listeners in Europe and South America, in setting up their own learning cluster, how could they find out the process of doing that?
Sure. I'm actually doing it right now in a number of northern cities in Afghanistan. The way we start is that usually one or two people who hear about me contact me, and I ask them to reach out among their friends and family and try to find at least three more people. We create a small Facebook chat or WhatsApp chat, and we sort of lay the ground expectations of what we're doing and what we're trying to achieve. And the people in that seed group can be a combination of students, would-be students, and would-be mentors. But what we need to then do is some brainstorming together. We brainstorm about marketing, because every city is different. In some cities, you need to get into the religious organizations. In some cities, you need to find donor-supported organizations where you're going to find Wi-Fi and computers and space. We always have to address the space question. While Breakaway Learning is brand new, I'm not so naive about the risks. Ultimately, it's about adults convening minors, right?
Yeah.
We don't want that to happen in homes. We don't want it to happen in apartments. We want minors and their parents to be fully aware that this needs to be an informed decision. I would rather that they meet at a Target cafe or a Walmart cafe, meet at a coffee shop that has free Wi-Fi. The groups in Afghanistan are getting cooperation arrangements with local businesses that I talk to that offer to share their meeting rooms. And so we start circulating among the in-group a spreadsheet of places that are willing to share rooms. So we sort of know where they are.
Right.
But it's so manual in the beginning. Honestly, we have to message people and call people. And sometimes I have to talk to a young person to understand what their learning interests are and show them screenshot by screenshot over Messenger. This is how you do it for them to understand.
Excellent. So you will probably be hearing from more than one person in this audience. And, you know, you bring up a good point. There is – are you familiar with the work of Lenore Skenazy?
No.
She was called the worst mother in the world. I think this was probably about 10 years ago. because she let her 8-year-old son ride the subway in New York by himself. And it wasn't like she opened the front door of her house, pushed him out and said, go ride the subway. There was a lot of preparation and a lot of situational role plays before he went out and actually did this. You know, so she was reported and it became this outrage and she built a brand around it. And, you know, she said, we need to stop bubble wrapping our children, this helicopter parenting, this lack of, not that, you know, kids should just be released to do whatever they want, but parents shouldn't be arrested for letting their kids walk home from school. And parents, most importantly, should not be constantly reinforcing the message of school by communicating to their children that they are not worthy of respect or trust, right? Because that is the outcome of bubble-wrapped kids, as she called it, and helicopter parenting. So yes, that is a problem in the United States that could be a potential obstacle. But I would say that people in this audience are aware of that problem. They're much more proactive. The people I met are very engaged with their kids. They're willing to have these conversations with their kids. They trust their kids because they've prepared their kids for these situations. And, you know, the kids in turn prepare themselves for these kinds of situations, especially by the time they've reached, you know, middle and high school.
Well, Lenore and I should make t-shirts together. I have been known for booting my children into uncomfortable situations at a fairly young age. And luckily outside of U.S. jurisdiction, so they can't get me.
John Taylor Gatto, are you familiar with John Taylor Gatto? He really took this approach when he taught middle school in a public school. I mean, if he was doing what he was, this was like in the early 90s, he was doing this before a lot of the panic. He was releasing kids out into the community in Manhattan to have challenging real world experiences. And, you know, today kids are kept in bubbles. But that was one of the things that he promoted, is give them opportunities to do things in the real world, to encounter danger, to encounter real challenge and to solve problems, because that's something that gives them confidence. It's something that gives them dignity, you know?
For sure. For sure. Well, I've gone through years of community and extended family thinking that I'm a lunatic. When my son was 11, I made him swim across the Mekong River with me. And when he was 12, I sent him off to live with a family in Mongolia for a month. Mm. I believe that at a certain point, a young person needs to be outside of their comfort zone. But it has been a question, how do you scale that? How do you turn it into something that's not about a particular crazy mom, a particular family, but it's actually an experience accessible to a lot of people? You mentioned homeschoolers and your listeners. I think that among urban homeschoolers and urban homeschool associations, this kind of learning cluster behavior is really already happening.
Right.
It's the question, can the market get deeper? Can it be as sophisticated as Airbnb? Can it be diverse? So that I could, you know, pull up an app and find the neuroscience cluster or find the Saving the Blue Whale cluster.
Well, Colleen, there's so much we could talk about. I would love to have you back in the near future and we can just continue this conversation. There's a lot we didn't get to today, but I want to be respectful of your time and the fact that I know that you have children babysitting other children right now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for all of the information. And I really look forward to seeing where this project goes in the next few months and few years. And we will talk again soon.
Thank you so much again, Brett. Take care. When you hear the sound.